Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. The films are Women Talking, Lady Chatterley's Lover, and Glass Onion. Hi, David.
Well, three films today, two of which really do center to some extent on women. So that's maybe a bit of a mini theme for today's talk. Let's begin with one about talk, which is called Women Talking. This is a new movie that's getting a lot of buzz, a lot of people very interested in it, and rightly so. It's an interesting movie. I don't think it's a great movie, but it's a very interesting one. Written and directed by Sarah Polley, although it's based on a novel, Sarah Polley is very much the creator of this movie. And it's based on a real case that took place many a long year ago, where in a Mennonite community back in the earlier part of the 2000s, some men from the local community in Canada — Sarah Polley is a Canadian actor and filmmaker — some men drugged and raped a number of women in this Mennonite religious community. And it was, of course, a horrifying thing that happened. And eventually a bunch of men were arrested and put on trial for this and punished for this. And that is what this movie is based on. But that sounds like maybe it's some sort of a bloody film full of horrifying violence and so forth. It is really not that at all. The movie is called Women Talking, and it is very much women talking. We have a whole bunch of women in this religious community, which is way out in the middle of nowhere, very far from cities. And we have them discussing what they are going to do. This horrible incident has just taken place. These women have been attacked, have been raped. They've recovered from the physical trauma, but some of them are pregnant, and they are now deciding just exactly what action they are going to take. And the community is only offering them really a couple of actions. They can either stay and forgive the men. The community will require them to forgive the men who attacked them and did these horrifying things to them, or they can leave, which means heading off into the wilderness with their possessions and nothing else really, and not knowing where they will go or what they will do when they get there. And this is what they are deciding. This is what they are talking over throughout the whole course of this movie. What will we do? Now, the trouble with this movie, in my view — and this may be based on the real case, but I don't think it's made very articulate in the way the movie is developed in the screenplay — it seems like a rather stark choice that these women have, and it's not clear exactly why they are willing to see things in the terms presented to them, which is to say, either they stay and forgive the men, which a number of these women feel is something they simply could not possibly do, or they have to leave and head off into the middle of nowhere with absolutely no idea of what they will do when they get there or how they will even survive. So this is what they're discussing, and it just seems to me to be a very difficult decision for them to make, a kind of a difficult situation for the moviegoer to really deal with. Why isn't there some other option? Why isn't there some middle ground? Why isn't there some way that they could somehow maybe talk with the elders of the community and come to some at least slightly different sort of arrangement? Now, again, maybe this is the way it really was in the real life case that all of this is based on. It's based on the real life case and then on a book that was based itself on the real life case. But I just wish that the movie articulated that better. Let us know a little bit more as to exactly what the thinking is among the elders of the community, for example, why it has to be this way. Anyway, with that big hesitation, I have to say that the movie is very recommendable in all kinds of other respects, and certainly it has a sensational cast. Almost, not all, but almost all of the characters in this movie are women. And of course, since most movies to this day continue to be centered mainly upon men, it is very refreshing to see such an enormous number of really gifted female actors playing female characters who are interesting and complex in all kinds of ways. We have Rooney Mara, Claire Foy, Jesse Buckley, Frances McDormand, Judith Ivey. I won't even list all the rest of them. There's just a whole bunch of women who do very interestingly in this movie. And then as the one significant male character, Ben Whishaw, who is also very good, very interesting portrayal by him. So this is, as should be clear from what I've said so far, a dialogue-driven movie. It is not driven by action. Very little actually happens in this movie. Mostly we have these women sitting around a barn and talking and trying to work things out. They disagree with each other. They agree with each other. They come up with different ways of talking about these things. Again, I wish that we had a little clearer sense as to exactly why things are set up the way they are, with the extremely stark choice that these women are presented with. But if we can accept that, that's just the way it is in the situation, then it's really quite an interesting movie. And again, very, very interested in language and in verbal acting, in having these women be discussing these things and talking about these things and making their decisions all in terms of language. That is very much what women talking is about, is language. So I feel that it is a very powerful feminist game which is being played here, and a very serious feminist game. I do think that the deck is stacked, however. I wish that the movie were a little bit clearer in why the women are presented with precisely the choice that they are. If they were, then maybe I would feel it related a little bit more to our own current debates in today's American society. As it is, I feel that the movie is sort of stuck in a different time and place, which makes it a little bit less immediate to today's feminist concerns where I live and where I operate than the movie quite manages to be. But let's move to another movie, which is also centered to some extent on a woman. And this is Lady Chatterley's Lover. And yes, this is in fact based on the very great D.H. Lawrence novel. When I was growing up, you heard a lot about the D.H. Lawrence novel, Lady Chatterley's Lover, because you couldn't get it in the United States when I was a little kid. It was banned because of its sexual content. Now, of course, it's all over the place. Things have changed a lot in that department. When I finally read it as a grown-up, I discovered it's a very, very serious novel. One got the impression back in the early 1950s and middle 1950s that it was a novel all about sex. In fact, it does have a lot to do with sex, and some of the sex is fairly explicit, but it's very much a movie about class also, as is even suggested in the title, Lady Chatterley's Lover. So what we have in Lady Chatterley's Lover, the novel, and also the new movie adaptation — this is not the first movie adaptation, but this is a very good adaptation. It's a Netflix film, by the way, so it's easily available. We have a woman who marries an aristocrat named Chatterley, and he goes off to fight in World War I, and he comes back very disabled. He is in a wheelchair, and he apparently is not capable of having sexual relations anymore. So Lady Chatterley, as she is now called — her name is Connie — she has to adjust to this new situation, and she does adjust pretty successfully. And she and her disabled husband are living in a lot of luxury, by the way. He's a lord, and he has all kinds of lovely estate that they live on, and servants and all of that. So that's just fine. Only she gets to know the gamekeeper on the estate, a man of the working classes whose name is Oliver Mellors. And eventually Lady Chatterley falls deeply in love with him. And that's where the big class angle of this story comes in, which is really the dominant theme of the whole thing. We have her. She is an aristocratic lady married to an aristocrat, and she has fallen in love with the gamekeeper, a man of a much lower class than hers. And it is a very passionate affair, a very torrid affair, and eventually it becomes known. And then it becomes, of course, a great scandal. So, and then we see how the whole thing plays out eventually, and that's what the whole last part of the story is about. The new Lady Chatterley's Lover movie is beautifully done. It was directed by Laure de Clermont-Tonnerre, who is a very, very gifted filmmaker. And this is very nicely done. It's very conventional. It's long, it's over 2 hours, and it's done in a very conventional, sort of traditional style of movie making. And yes, as in the novel, there is a fair amount of sexuality here, a fair amount of sexual activity. There's nudity and sex and all that stuff goes on. But as with the novel, we shouldn't let that really take over our impression of what the whole thing is about. It is very much a story of class, a story of class as it was enacted in England around a century ago, but not completely irrelevant to today's concerns with class in our own class society. And there is a lot of sex, but again, that's really not the main point of the thing. Very, very nicely acted. The main characters, Emma Corrin, Jack O'Connell, Jolie Richardson is in it, various others. It's a very, very well acted movie and a very beautifully photographed movie. There's all kinds of beautiful sort of just nature cinematography and so forth. So it's a beautifully done movie. So a good movie, not a great movie, a fine adaptation, not an eye-opening adaptation. It doesn't teach us new things about the class system. It doesn't teach us new things about D.H. Lawrence's novel, but it's a very, very fine adaptation of it, and I really had a good time watching it. Again, I recommend the novel. I would say read that even instead of seeing the movie, because it's a terrific novel, this new movie, is a very responsibly done movie and a very nicely done movie, and again, just a beautiful movie to look at. Lady Chatterley's Lover, a good adaptation of a very fine novel. And the last film for today, Glass Onion. This is a sequel of sorts to the movie Knives Out, which came out just a few years ago. And Glass Onion is being identified in its promotion as a Knives Out mystery, and that's really exactly what it is. Now, Knives Out, which came out a few years ago, written and directed by Rian Johnson, it's very, very popular. Popular enough, in fact, to have spawned this sequel. It didn't do much for me. I'm not much of a fan of whodunits, so I didn't have a very good time looking at Knives Out. It was very well done and all that, but it just wasn't exactly my kind of movie. So to my great surprise, Glass Onion turns out to be more my kind of movie. I really had a good time looking at it. It's way over 2 hours long. I don't think it needs to be that long. And I think about the last third of it I liked less than the rest of it. But my gosh, I had a really good time for maybe the first hour and a half of this movie, which for me and a whodunit is quite a long time to be enjoying it. So I really do have to recommend Glass Onion. So it's a sequel of sorts, although most of the characters are brand new. The character who is not brand new is the main character, Benoit Blanc, a very southern detective, played by Daniel Craig. And oh gosh, he does a wonderful job with his character. It's a beautifully humorously done thing. He does the southern accent beautifully. It's really a lot of fun to watch him. So what happens is that a number of people at the very beginning of the movie find themselves invited to a very strange party that is being given by a guy named Miles Braun, who is played by Edward Norton. He has invited these people, and his invitation is a very strange one. About several people receive a big wooden box with no idea of how to open it. So what we see at the beginning of the movie is these different people figuring out how in the world to open this box. And eventually they do figure it out, and they find inside various mechanisms and workings, and they have to sort of figure out a little puzzle. And then inside everything, they find an invitation to this party, which is going to be at Miles Braun's fabulous estate, which is on an island way, way out in the ocean. And apparently he has one of these gatherings every year, and they're all going to go there. And he says it's going to be an unusual party because as part of the fun, they're going to have to solve a murder mystery. Miles Braun, their incredibly wealthy host, is going to be murdered, he says, and they'll have to figure out who did the murder. So this is all just a game, and they're all going to go there. One of the people who gets invited is Benoit Blanc, the world's greatest detective. It turns out later on that he wasn't really invited, and that's where the whole sort of complication of the movie starts to come in. It turns out that he's there for other reasons, and if there does turn out to be a murder, more than one in fact, and Benoit Blanc, the world's greatest detective, has to solve it with help from various of the other guests. So that's what it's all about. Now, part of the fun of this movie is the Miles Braun character, beautifully played by Edward Norton. Here's how fabulously wealthy he is. He has the Mona Lisa, not a reproduction, but the actual Leonardo da Vinci Mona Lisa, just hanging in his living room. So that's the kind of fantasy that this movie ultimately is, and the kind of fabulous wealth that we're dealing with here. And so all these people have been invited to his party. So over the course of the party, we learn who they are, why they've been invited, what their relationship is to Miles Braun, what their relationships are to each other. And it's a lot of fun putting these different pieces together, partly because we have such a terrific cast playing these people. I'll mention some of the people: Kate Hudson, Dave Bautista, Janelle Monáe, Leslie Odom Jr., Madeline Klein, Noah Segan, a very, very varied and interesting cast. So, and by the way, Ethan Hawke plays a tiny little part over on the edge of the movie, but he's not really a main member of it. So what we have is this murder mystery that unfolds, some deaths take place, it's all very tastefully done, not a movie with a lot of violence in it, and there's a lot of humor in it, a lot of fun. I really did have a good time watching most of this movie. And above all, the two main performances by Daniel Craig as the world's greatest detective and by Edward Norton as the fabulously wealthy host of the party, they're just both wonderful, having a lot of fun with their roles, and I had a lot of fun watching them. There's another movie out right now about a bunch of people at an establishment out in the middle of nowhere with a lot of money surrounding them called The Menu, which is about an eccentric restaurant. I didn't much like The Menu, but I really do like Glass Onion. So whether or not you like Knives Out, and again, I think this is a great improvement on the original, I think Glass Onion is highly recommendable. I had a good time watching it. It's streaming. You can see it very easily, and hey, it's a good time at the movies. And so that is my somewhat woman-centered and somewhat comedy-centered story this week.
Thank you very much, as ever and always, David Sterrett, Films in Focus, the films Women Talking, Lady Chatterley's Lover, and Glass Onion.